Accession number 14201, reel 2.
Libby Carson, reel 2. You were saying about a deputation job.
I was a member of a group of four college students and an adult who went around to seven, one after another, Methodist parishes, and in the summer of 1941, and held meetings with their young people and the adults that worked with their young people. And we were meant to be useful to them. But I remember that that was the time that, it was the summer of 41, and that was the time when I realized that there were people who were members of my church who you get in step with God, and God is marching on, it's an Old Testament Christianity, okay? That, I think, it's a vindictive and simplistic, I believe, stance. But I got into a corner with one of the ministers of one of those the minister of one of those churches, because I had quoted Muriel Lester. And he didn't know Muriel Lester, but he heard what I said, she said. And he was just livid. And that it made me a dangerous person. And he didn't want that kind of pollution of his young people. And so forth. And I was stunned, because I didn't think that I was, you know, such a rat. And I learned a lot that summer.
Were you worried about your brother, you know, with his sort of attitudes, knowing that, you know, the situation might lead to war? You know, I wonder how you were sort of feeling about...
No, I suppose. No, I didn't worry about him. I think we all knew what he would do. He just simply had to do it himself. When he was in his year between high school and college, he had not yet been drafted, and he looked for a job which had no connection with the war, and it was hard to find one. But he did find a job with a decorative wrought iron man who refused war contracts, you see. He and Bill were of a like mind, and this man could have cleaned up, you know, how do you say in England, could have thrown his dice and won, being part of the war effort. It was a lucrative thing to do, and but he was not interested either. So Bill worked with him. And that kind of thing interests the draft board, because somewhere else is going to be better pay.
So could I ask you now then, you know, about the the fact that he was sent to this mental home to work, and what made you go and join him? You know, if I could get onto this stage.
Well, he was under selective service, and the way the statutes were written, they were to be assigned alternative service of national importance, and some of them felt as if they were being of national importance, and some of them said, boy, I'm telling you, I don't know if I can see this through, being on the shelf like this and being of no use when in an emergency, extended emergency and so forth. Well, Bill Anderson, his first assignment was where California and Nevada join, and Carson City, Nevada is on the west edge of Nevada against California's east edge, and around in there were, I think, 6 or 7 spike camps. They were groups of 5 or 6 or 10 young men who were doing a very specific job for a particular length of time, like planting trees against erosion, or digging ditches for some village sewer plant, or whatever. And one of them, and Bill's job was to drive a truck round. It took a week to do this, to stop at each spike camp with supplies and pick up laundry and stuff like that, and keep this all straight, and stop here, stop here, stop here, and go back to Carson City. That took, that was a week, I think. And one of his stops was a person who was all alone. He was all by himself, and he was a fire watcher. And he was working on a PhD thesis. And so one of Bill's jobs was to return his books to the state library and to pick up the ones that he wanted and take them back out to him in another week's time. And things like that. And then the Methodist Church was starting a unit of workers at this enormous mental hospital in Cherokee, Iowa, and so Bill was assigned there, and he and these others, I don't know how many altogether there were who came through there and went. Came and went, you know, but Bill was one of the early ones, I think, just after it was established, a few months after it was established. Let's say 40 men over a period of several years came and went.
What was it that made you want to go and join them? You know, because you are the person we're interested in, really.
Oh,
what you know? Why did you decide to go and join your brother there?
Well, I had graduated from college, and the family were living in a town. They had moved, so they were living in a city where I had no acquaintance. And at any rate, Bill wrote and said that this was very interesting work and that they surely needed me if I wanted to come. And I did that. That's all. And
Were you making a statement against the war, do you think, by...
I didn't think of it that way. Nobody cared, see. Nobody cared what I did. And no, I don't think I was making a statement about the war. The only thing is that when I got there, the community had sent these guys to Coventry. And there was absolutely no one. There was one civil person. One person. She was a research librarian at this little tiny library. She worked down in the cellar of this little bitty library in this little bitty town outside of in northwest Iowa. And in that way, I was paid attention to because people took great pains not to speak to me. or anybody, you know, anybody who associated in any way with the COs who were yellows. They were yellow.
Is that what the attitude was towards them, that they were cowards?
In that time. And I don't know where else. I babysat one time for a Navy man, an officer. He came back and he came back home, he and his wife from, you know, a night out. And he asked me, I don't know how we got on this conversation, but I said something about conscientious objector. And he said, those yellow bellies are the best goddamn guinea pigs I ever saw in anybody's lab. And see, this is a mixed message. I don't know how drunk he was, you know, I don't know how really soused he was at the moment, but he was either in derision or in a kind of conspiracy with me, was using that term for these guys, but then he was making an admiring statement. Hardly anybody was indifferent. That's true, I believe. I think that's true.
What sort of work were you doing in this mental hospital? You know, was it arduous and difficult work?
Well, it was a responsibility that I wasn't prepared for. I knew no nursing whatever, but I would, and I know now the risks that the hospital took in putting me where they did, which was night women's receiving at night. Because many people, most of the time in receiving, a person is in a manic state. Hardly anybody comes to be, you know, to be brought to the hospital as a patient who isn't disturbed. So but from 7 in the evening to 7 in the morning, I was responsible for these women, many of whom were still, you know, continued to be in a manic state. Or when anybody in another part of the hospital broke, when there was an episode and this person acted out, was brought to receiving for what was called re-diagnosis, but it only meant calming down, you know. But there was one woman who was moaning, and I went to her and, you know, tried to, and asked her in the ward and in the night, and I tried to ask her what was the matter, and then I didn't understand what she said to me, and it didn't, at any rate, she was diabetic. And I did not know that. And it wasn't with the papers. And that's a terrible state of affairs. And but I did that for 6 or 7 months, and
the CEOs would have been doing the same thing, would they?
They were, many of them were assigned to violent ward, and there were shackles and straitjackets and things like that, and a lot of retaliation on the part of keepers, you know, the people with the keys.
Yeah, yes. How did your brother stand up to that, do you think? How did he?
Well, they all had to devise ways of dealing with people who were strong and using muscular strength and without reason, you know, or in the absence of reason. So there was, at lunchtime, which was sort of 11 o'clock at night, that there would be conversation about that, and about, this is the way I saw it, this is the way this rose. Now, what does a guy do? And they helped one another that way. Sometimes there was more than one person on a ward, and sometimes it wasn't. But hospitals were not hospitals; they were sort of keeping places. Well, that's easy for me to say, but there was such neglect, and there was such, shall we say, we don't want to know on the part of the public, that mental hospitals were, they had fancy names like loony bin and bedlam, and which is part of the language, and things like crazy house, you know. And they were a person was object of ridicule who was sick. And this, a great deal has changed since then.
Do you think the CEOs, and you know the work you did, was a factor in that change? You know, were you able to do anything?
Well, I'm sure of that, yes. I'm sure of that, and I think that it's almost a direct line. Because among the CEOs, there were people of already in professions, you see. There and several of those were lawyers. And so we had a little leaflet that we could subscribe to if we wanted to. I got this little thing, it's called The Attendant, put out sometimes, every once in a while, by some guys who were located at one of the big, enormous, notorious mental hospitals in New Jersey. And one of the things that they did was to urge the men to make affidavits of what they had seen and what they had, and, you know, participation, observation, and so forth. And they and send them to these instigators in New Jersey, and they collected affidavits that would fill a big garage, and they took these to Eleanor Roosevelt and Pearl Buck, and one other woman who I cannot remember who she was, but she was as eminent in that same way as a humanitarian and a vigorous, concerned person. And they hatched the Mental Health Association. That's what happened. And all these things came to light. And I think it's just a direct cause and effect myself. I think. I have not seen the archives of the Mental Health Association. I haven't researched this. This is what I think. Yeah.
Your brother also had something to do with a starvation program, did he not?
Yes, he. This was invented. This was set up to find out how best to reconstitute people who had been terribly emaciated, and there, and the sort of call went out, you know, and you could volunteer for this. In fact, there was no such thing as assignment for any of the guinea pig experiments in insect bites, in bed rest. These are research projects, you see. And so was this at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. And so they had many, many, many volunteers. It was to be 1 year in duration. And then they selected carefully. They had good stuff to select from, which was there were different soma. This is a tall rangy, okay? That's my brother, tall rangy, gentle disposition. Then there were slight wiry mercurial disposition. You know, there were these categories. I think there were four categories, and there were 36 people selected. And
so were they all COs?
Yes, yeah. And those who were not selected, who had volunteered, you see, then that they just would figure out something else to do. That until Selective Service was through with them. But this was 3 months of very careful diet, and it was weighed to the gram, and they were not to eat anything. They could drink, but not with sugar in it. And rules like that. Every day, a certain number of minutes on the treadmill, and a certain number of minutes in eye-hand dexterity and balance. And so then their metabolism was put on a curve. And Bill's diet was one of four diets. It was root vegetables and fish. And it was, I think it was 1,200 calories, or 1,220 or something. They were to walk 27 miles a week. And apart from that, and their treadmill work and so forth, they could do as they wished. And sometimes they wished and sometimes they didn't. Bill joined the university chorus in the Messiah, and he fainted off the risers. And so they picked him up and put him between two stronger tenors who held him under his elbows. And he completed the Messiah.
Did he have to stay in the university while these trials were ongoing?
He had to be there every day for everybody did, to check in with the researchers. Eye-hand dexterity, balance, treadmill work.
How about the food? What did he have that there or at home?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And it was like it was fixed in a lab. Yeah. And nobody else ate at that cafeteria. It was a place under the what do you call those? Under the tiers of seats at the university field house bowl. The stadium under the sports stadium at the University of Minnesota.
What sort of effect did this diet have on him? You know, you've explained about the fainting, but did he lose a lot of weight?
Well, yes, he looked like someone from Buchenwald. He was bones. His knees were knobby, his ankles, his skull. It's a great... He learned that no one should ever be hungry. And he spent his life as an agricultural person. And that was a direct line, too. Yes, I went to visit him once there, and I thought, well, we'll sit around and sing some folk songs, you know. No, it was the quietest, most quietest. Every motion was made with forethought for efficiency. And I heard nobody laugh, and people who spoke to one another spoke as softly. Now these are 22-year-old guys. They're old men. They're old men. And when they got a chance, they threw themselves on the lawn outside and just watch the sky and
did they suffer any pains, you know?
There were some things, yes. They were in joints. In joints. There was joint pain. And I really don't know a lot about it. That's the truth. I really don't know a lot about those findings. One of the things they found out was that a piece of chewing gum has 8 calories, because one of the men was not following his curve when the diet began and the regimen began, so there was no more intake than what was prescribed. This young man did not follow his curve. And so they had to ask him, what have you been eating? I haven't been eating anything. No, I've been good. Well, at any rate, they discovered that he constantly chewed gum. And that they had to cut him down from that, because it wasn't according to Hoyle.
Were the results used for anything, do you know?
I'm sure they were, and I don't know. I really ought to follow that up just for my own curiosity. But I know that the things that were learned, for instance, that vitamins alone are not enough to help. Vitamins have to be coupled with food intake in order to be rehabilitative. And a lot of, yes, findings are still used. They were commissioned by the person who invented K-rations.